Okay, welcome everyone to this week's quantum gravity seminar. Our guest speaker today is Morgan Lynch from Technion, and he will talk about experimental observation of acceleration-induced formality. Our speaker is fine with questions during the talk. If you want to ask a question, please raise your virtual hand or use the chat function. With that, Morgan, the stage is yours.
Okay, so Benjamin, thank you very much. And so thank you to you and to the organizer, Alicia, for the opportunity to speak today. And so so as I was introduced, my name is Morgan Lynch. I've just finished up my postdoc at the Technion, and the work that I'll be presenting today deals with basically thermalized accelerated observables, which incorporate things like the Uhuru effect, which I applied to a recent high energy channeling radiation experiment and got some pretty interesting results. And so those are the things that I was gonna talk with you guys about today. And so then to begin, So in terms of the structure of this talk, what I wanted to do is give a little bit of a historical background about the beginnings of quantum field theory in curved space-time. We'll talk a little bit of things of the work that was done by Schrodinger, Parker, Hawking, and Uhuru, and the eventual, I guess, path that this research take in towards a space-time thermality. And then we'll also look at various examples of analog gravity that were designed specifically to measure these phenomena. And then from there, we're going to move on to some new results. This will be the application of some of the theoretical developments that I and some colleagues had developed, and we apply this to this high energy channeling radiation experiment. This is done by the NA63 collaboration at CERN. We'll go over basically the theoretical developments that went into that, how we could incorporate things like radiation reaction and Uhuru effect into these, and then we'll go through the analysis that we did of that. And then we'll close with a little bit of the future outlooks that we have and how this project, et cetera, fits into these analog gravitational systems and what else we can do in the future. And so the general idea of this project was to look at high energy particle physics where you have extreme accelerations, but rather than looking at, say, a momentum transfer in a collision, we wanted to look at the extreme accelerations that you would have in, say, an experiment like channeling radiation and do QED in curved space-time rather than just proper particle physics. And so to begin, let's look a little bit at our historical background. Let's talk about the Schrodinger paradox and some of the early work from Erwin Schrodinger. So after he essentially just wrote down his wave equation, and I think he applied it first to the hydrogen atom to derive the spectra from hydrogen, he didn't rest on his laurels and immediately turned to looking at these wave equations in the general relativistic backgrounds that Einstein had been looking at as well. And what he had found was that in general, you have these standard wave equations and all of the curvature and general relativity essentially puts itself in a form of just an exotic potential. And one of the things that he had found was particle creation. And one way we could think about this is if you have just kind of a standard quantum mechanical particle in a box, whenever you have, say, a particle in the ground state, and then whenever you expand the box, you get non-zero probabilities to populate higher excited states. And so this is in a standard quantum mechanical treatment, but the analog of this in quantum or second quantized quantum field theory, you end up with particle creation. And one way to think about this is, say, this potential, if this acts like a scattering potential, you end up with the particle incoming, which then you have a transmitted wave and a reflected wave. And this is analogous to, say, pair creation. And when you incorporate this in an expanding universe, you get this runaway particle creation, which essentially lases particles, or in this case, photons, what he was thinking of, into the universe, which would completely saturate the universe. And this led to essentially an Olbers paradox, where if this process was actually occurring, why isn't the universe completely populated with light? And so this was an initial paradox way back in 1939, whenever the first attempt to look at quantum fields in curved space-time was taking place. And this paradox was solved by Leonard Parker during his PhD thesis by incorporating the Bogolyubov transformation. And so what I would like to do now is just go over the Bogolyubov transformation to get an idea of how these things look. So if we have a generic wave equation, say we have a Klein-Gordon equation in a curved space-time, that curved space-time will take the form of a potential, okay? And if we consider, say, two vacuum states or two separate sets of positive and negative frequency modes that we can use to second quantize our fields here, right? We can use the completeness relation of the wave equations to write, say, the wave function of a particle in vacuum one as terms of a linear combination of the modes from vacuum two and vice versa. However, whenever you have second quantized your fields, these the coefficients are promoted to creation and annihilation operators. And so you need also a transformation law which relates the creation and annihilation operators to each other when you do the mode expansion in terms of the other eigenstates. And these are known as the Bogolyubov transformations. One thing to note here is that, say, we have your annihilation operator and your creation operator, some of the other vacua, is gauged by this beta Bugalov coefficient in both cases. And these are the terms that mix the positive and negative frequency modes of each of the vacua. And so the fact that you're getting these mixing of positive and negative frequency modes is where essentially you give rise to this pair creation whenever you have, say, an expanding universe. And one thing that we can do is we can compute, say, the number operator. How many particles from vacuum two, or from our positive and negative frequency modes from vacuum two, are present in vacuum one? And it's given by beta squared. And likewise, vice versa, how many of our A particles are present in vacuum two? And again, it's the beta squared. And so what we have now is the computation of things like these number operators, which lies at the heart of quantum field theory and curved space-time. And what it does is it enables you via this Bugalov transformation to map observables as you switch vacua or switch your basis of eigenstates. And so then now let's look at this birth of quantum field theory and curved spacetime, how Parker was able to incorporate this in and then thereby solve the this Schrodinger paradox. Okay, here's Parker in Valencia, Spain, visiting some colleagues, Jose Navarro Salas out in Valencia. I should say that I did my PhD at UWM where Parker is located, and I went out there specifically for him. I worked on my own, but just for that fact that he was there, I was able to talk with him and things like this. And so what he did then was when he applied these Bugalov transformations to an expanding universe, what he had found is that for conformally invariant wave equations, which photons obey in expanding universes, you get no particle creation when analyzed via this Bugalov technique. And so he was able to actually look at the creation of particles by the expansion of the universe, except now they're tempered. It's not a runaway effect. But what he had found was that the initial result was not thermal. This was back in his PhD thesis. He was working under Sidney Coleman at Harvard at the time. No one at the time had any idea to look for thermality in these systems. And so, you know, he gets these expressions, which for cosmologies are actually really complicated expressions. So the idea that thermality was present there was not known at the time. It wasn't until Bekenstein was, say, ascribing an entropy to black holes, and then Hawking found his result, that thermality was found. But after that, Parker later went back and found that these distribution of particles is in fact thermal in certain limits, okay, where the actual temperature is dependent on the initial scale factor at the Planck time. So what you have is you start your initial condition at some later time to avoid the singularity, and then it's just gauged by the scale factor at the final time. So this acts essentially like a Hubble constant, A dot over A, where the A dot, the derivative, is just the initial scale factor divided by the Planck time. And so this is the first time that we're incorporating this Bugalov transformation into quantum field theories and curved space-time. Later on, Hawking, utilizing this Bugalov technique, looked at the particles created by a spherically symmetric and pressureless collapsing ball of dust. Here's Hawking at the Perimeter Institute. As you guys know, there's an entire Hawking wing that's out there. And the idea that that there should be some thermality associated with this thing coming from Bekenstein then would prompt Hawking to start looking for these thermal distributions and, in particular, find a temperature from these things. And what he had found, again, we find our thermal distribution where the temperature is determined by the surface gravity of the black hole. And if we actually look explicitly at this temperature, we see H bar, we see capital G. So the fact that we have that is already a bona fide quantum gravitational quantity. But more surprisingly is we also get Boltzmann constant. And what's really interesting about this is what we have is that at the intersection of quantum mechanics and classical general relativity, thermodynamics comes out of this. So instead of, say, finding like a grand unified theory, what we get is like a unification of the subjects or of the pillars of modern physics. And so this thermal result prompted a flurry of work. And in particular, what Bill Unruh was doing was looking at, say, a Schwarzschild black hole, where he took a particle in a box, which is the prototype for what's now called an Unruh-DeWitt detector. There'll be more to say about that. And was essentially analyzing the character of this Hawking radiation in the near horizon limit of the Schwarzschild black hole. And what he had found was that the transition rate of these boxes, or the transition rate of this Unruh-DeWitt detector, was in fact thermal. The temperature was proportional to the acceleration. This work had been built, was building on the work of Stephen Fulling and Paul Davies. Fulling had been looking at, say, Bugalov transformations between Minkowski and the Rindler wedge for uniform acceleration. Paul Davies looked at the 1+1 dimensional moving mirror. And all of these works combined together, this temperature is now known as the Fulling-Davies-Unruh temperature. And I should also mention that here's Bill Unruh at the Perimeter Institute with friends. This was for the graduation of Yasuman right here, who was working with Nayesh and Rafi. And I was actually there during this time period as a visiting graduate fellow with Nayesh, and we were able to do some really cool work on generalized temperatures, which incorporated things like Unruh temperature in them. And so now we've had the particle creation by an expansion of the universe, creation of a black hole, and then moving into an accelerated reference frame. Let's complete this picture of thermality by looking at the thermodynamics of space-time itself. So building on the results of Bekenstein, we can look at some of the work that Jacobson did. Let's focus work on Bekenstein. Based off the idea that the area of the event horizon of a black hole can never decrease, that almost kind of sounds so much like an entropy, that entropy can never decrease. So he conjectured that the surface area, or that there would be an entropy associated with the surface area of the black hole. And so Hawking, having found the temperature, was able to integrate the second law of thermodynamics here with the Hawking temperature that he had found to confirm that indeed there is an entropy that is associated with the black hole, and it is indeed proportional to the surface area, with the coefficient being 1/4. Carrying over this thermodynamic dynamic analysis a little further, if we consider a Rindler particle, a Rindler observable, say a particle or just a generic observer, where you have, say, some flux of energy momentum which goes through the Rindler horizon here. The energy content which goes through this horizon can be determined, say, if we have a set of, say, null vectors, okay, which kind of span a ring on our horizon, which is essentially a big black wall, but we could define a ring of null vectors on the horizon, and the total flux of energy that goes through it can be sensed by the contraction of these null vectors with the energy momentum which falls through the horizon. And then at the same time, we can have essentially a gravitational lensing or Rachow-Dury geodesic deviation of these null rays due to the Ricci tensor here, which gives you a change in the area as these null rays are bent out. And if you use the hypothesis from the second law here with the Unruh temperature in this case, you can formulate the second law of thermodynamics here. And what you find by integrating this is that you find the Einstein equation. And the implication of this is that the Einstein equation is simply just a thermodynamic equation of state for these kind of weird quantum fluctuations that you get in these curved space-time settings. And so the implication is that gravity is just simply kind of a thermodynamic emergent phenomenon that you get. And so this kind of completes the picture of this thermality when you look at quantum field theory in curved space-time. And so now let's look at attempts to measure this. And this brings us to the field of what's now called analog gravity. This was essentially started by this paper by Bill Unruh, where I believe he was teaching a course in fluid dynamics. And just by looking at the wave equations that you get in certain fluid regimes, you can map them to the wave equations for quantum fields in curved spacetimes. And so this gives us our analog for looking at these in terms of fluids. And one of the first things, or one of my favorite ones, is if you have, say, just a bathtub drain, you could look at super radiant scattering. So if you have your drain and you put just a plane wave coming in, that the frequency or energy can be upscattered and increased or accelerated. And so you could find super radiance in these systems. At the same time, you could also look at stimulated Hawking emission. So if I had fluid flow over this wing here, the mass flow rate has to be constant. So as you kind of pinch the fluid, it has to flow faster. So you end up with a sonic horizon here in the middle. And then if you stimulate it with a wave chopper here, you can induce pair creation of these positive and negative frequency waves, which follow precisely, the frequency distribution follows precisely this Boltzmann distribution at the Hawking temperature inferred by the surface gravity of that sonic horizon. So not only do we get stimulated Hawking emission, we get spontaneous Hawking emission. This is work done by Steinhauer at the Technion. He was in the building across the way from me here. This is his BEC setup. And what you have now is essentially a pencil-shaped Bose-Einstein condensate. And here's our confining potential well. And if we take a laser spot and chop it in half, this red half laser spot here, and scan it across, what we end up with is a potential with a sharp edge. And as we scan that across, say, here's the density of the BEC, you end up with essentially a waterfall here. And so in the same case, you have a sonic horizon at that waterfall as the fluid goes faster than the speed of sound for the BEC. And you get a spontaneous now quantum phonon pair creation from these, whose frequency distribution again follows this Boltzmann tail in agreement with the Hawking temperature that you would infer from the sonic horizon. More recently, another paper by Steinhauer working with collaborators in France, is what we can have is, say, a cell of a BEC of rubidium atoms, which is a cylindrical cell. And what we do is you fire a laser beam into it. This laser beam will sense the index of a fraction of this BEC, which produces a nonlinear Kerr effect, which causes the beam to contract. Okay, so this laser spot size actually contracts when it goes in. And then when it exits the chamber, you have a spontaneous expansion of the laser spot. And whenever you, and this is an analog to an expanding space-time. And so what we see here, this is momentum space as a function of time. As this laser spot expands, you see these interference fringes and you get these particle creation, which looks eerily similar to these temperature fluctuations you see in the CMB. But this is now some of the various examples that we have for measuring these curved spacetime phenomenon. And so the question then is can we find a fundamental system where we can analyze these things, right? We have super radiant scattering, we got Hawking and Parker, but is there a system that we can use for UNRU? And the fact that we have highly accelerated systems in particle physics then kind of points us toward, you know, something like the Large Hadron Collider, et cetera, to go look for these things. And so now I would like to start introducing some of these new results that we had worked on. We're going to be looking primarily at a QED, highly accelerated QED radiation emission, which incorporates the thermality of the UNRU effect. So for that, I would like to first introduce the UNRU DeWitt detector. So these two-level systems are actually quite robust at analyzing radiation emission from uniformly accelerated sources and can even model elementary particles as well. And so look at, say, the transition rate between the two levels of our UNRU DeWitt detector, kind of the prototype model for, in this case, a massless scalar field emission. We have our interaction action with our field phi, which gets emitted. And we have our monopole moment operator, which functions like a creation and annihilation operator to induce transitions within the detector. And so we could look at, say, moving through vacuum and our detector undergoing a transition accompanied by the emission of a particle phi. And we end up with a thermal response function. The thermal response function is just the transition rate of the detector. It's given by the standard Fourier transform of a two-point function. The frequency variable of that Fourier transform is simply the energy gap of the detector. And what we find is actually a thermal response function. So this is the same kind of response that you would get if you were to just immerse your two-level system into a bath, a thermal bath. And what we find is that under uniform acceleration, the temperature that we are thermalized at is indeed the Fooling-Davies-Munro temperature. And so what we want to do now is elevate this analysis to incorporate the QED interaction. And a very simple example to do this is with Cherenkov radiation. And with Cherenkov radiation, we also get the clue to incorporate radiation reaction. This is where we get the key to incorporating recoil. And so just to review, Cherenkov radiation comes from whenever you have a charged particle moving in an indexed medium faster than the speed of light in that medium. And just like you can get, say, sonic booms from a jet traveling faster than the speed of sound, you can get superluminal booms or light flashes for particles which are traveling faster than the speed of light in the medium. And the character of this radiation, the emissive spectrum, is known as the Frank-Tan formula. It's a very flat formula. It's independent of frequency. And all of this radiation gets dumped into this very well-defined Cherenkov ring or Cherenkov cone, which is given by this expression here. And so what we wanted to do initially was to reproduce this using our UNRU DeWitt detector. So let's look at our QED current interaction. Here we have our gauge field for our photon. And then the JMU is a semi-classical vector current coupled to our UNRU DeWitt detector. And when we look at our response function, we see the same Fourier transform of our two-point function, except we have our four velocities of our detector contracted with the indices of our photon field. So if you just note here, this is just the square of the V dot A interaction that you have here. And so whenever we evolve our detector on constant velocity in an index medium, we do indeed get our Frank-Tan formula. So we have our normalizations correct, we have our couplings correct, et cetera. And we also get our Cherenkov cone. But if you note, we also have our UNRU DeWitt detector energy gap. And so what we get is the anomalous Doppler effect for free. And what this means is if I have a standard Cherenkov cone, if I have an excitation of my detector, it bends the cone in. If I have a decay, it bends the cone out. At the same time, if I have a co-moving oscillation, something like if I have an accelerated particle that we'll see later on in the experiment we'll analyze, if there's a transverse co-moving oscillation, the frequency of that will just simply be plugged into this delta E right here. So any transverse co-moving oscillation will be present in this energy gap. And at the same time, the Cherenkov, the recoil correction to Cherenkov radiation is actually known already. And it presents itself in this Cherenkov angle. And so just by a judicious choice of our energy gap, we could also incorporate recoil or radiation reaction. But rather than just kind of willy-nilly just plugging in a generic term, what we wanted to do is find a good reason or a physical reason for having that recoil correction. And that brings us into mass renormalization in an indexed medium. So again, so if we define our energy gap as the difference between the initial and final electron energy, and what we want to do is we want to consider, okay, a mass renormalized electron moving superluminally in an index medium where you have your electron and the photon begins to build up and stick to it and hybridizes with this thing. And so we have our renormalized rest mass of our electron in the co-moving frame, okay? And then what happens is this thing forms essentially like a weird, I was calling it a vacuum polariton, but just kind of a fundamental type of atom with an electron and photon shell. And then it decays unstable. It's an unstable thing. It decays and you get an enhancement in your momentum from the index. Okay. And so now, whenever you just expand this out, this gives you your recoil kinetic energy, but this reproduces identically the known recoil correction produced by Sokolov for Cherenkov radiation. And this mass renormalization prescription comes from Sitovich. And this is mass renormalization in an indexed medium. If we're in vacuum, you simply don't have the mass renormalization and you get the kick from the momentum as well. So it's just omega squared over 2m in vacuum. And so this is kind of the insight that we get in how to incorporate recoil into radiation emission. And so we want to take that and apply this to this high energy channeling radiation. So let's give a little bit of a background, by the way, on radiation reaction. Radiation reaction, broadly speaking, is how to incorporate, or what is the equation of motion for an electron or for a charged particle, which incorporates the recoil into it. And so here we have a standard Lorentz force equation of motion. And here is the recoil corrections that we have. This is the standard recoil correction, the jerk term. And this is the relativistic correction for it. And so you end up with this paradox that you get, because if you're looking at, say, an accelerated charge, right, the acceleration will essentially determine the energy of the photon. And that energy of the photon will produce a kick, which produces the recoil, right? But that recoil that occurs also changes the acceleration. And so you end up kind of with a chicken and egg argument about what's the kind of steady state, or what's the final state photon frequency, which includes this back reaction. And so when you try to analyze this equation of motion, you end up with kind of problems of runaway solutions and things like this, all because of this. This is essentially a third order derivative on the position, but it's this higher order terms that caused a flurry of problems. Moreover, this is only the first order correction in alpha. And so this full equation of motion and understanding these things is an open problem, and it's the problem of radiation reaction. But what we found was a little bit of a grip into the problem by simply encoding the recoil or radiation reaction as a recoil kinetic energy in our Umbrudwy detector energy gap. And so the models that are going to be based on that people are using to analyze this channeling radiation experiment are all based on this Lorentz equation of motion. So let's look at that channeling radiation experiment. We have 178.2 GeV positrons, so very high energy positrons, which are fired into a 3.8 millimeter thick sample of single crystal silicon. Okay, single crystal means that you have a regular lattice structure. And so what you do is you align the crystal so that you could fire the positron beam down an axis of symmetry. And the atomic sites essentially act as a waveguide to the positrons. And since they're positrons, so they're positively charged, the atomic sites are also positively charged. And so it oscillates back and forth like a harmonic oscillator. So as the particle penetrates, it has a nice undulator motion to it. Okay, and so we can collect all these photons that are emitted. Here is the data presented by the group, Na63. The black points here are the data points, and the various colored curves here are the standard catalog of radiation reaction models, which are applied to this data set. These are variants of that Lorentz-Abraham-Dirac equation, that Lorentz force with the recoil correction. And they do Monte Carlo simulations incorporating certain quantum corrections. They use the Landau-Lifshitz equation as well. And what they do is they solve those equations of motion to get the acceleration, and then essentially plug that into the Larmor formula to get the radiation that's emitted from these. And so this is a power spectrum, energy per unit time per unit frequency, relatively easy observable to compute using things like the Unruh effect. And so let's now apply this thermalized QED, accelerated QED analysis to that data set. So let's look at our power spectrum. Again, here is our QED response function. What we want to do now is evolve our current along a uniformly accelerated world line. Here we have how we compute our power spectrum, simply the response function weighted by an additional factor of frequency, and then we just don't integrate over the frequencies itself. Our power spectrum is comprised of three Hankel functions. First term is actually just a scalar term. You get this term if you look at massless scalar fields. These two terms come from the photon polarization. A couple things to say about this now. First of all, note the presence of the energy gap is here in the index, okay? And if we look at a thermalized observable, so if we have an excitation or a de-excitation at thermal equilibrium, the population or the relative population should obey detailed balance. And so if you flip a sign in this energy gap, that goes from flipping from an excitation to a de-excitation, which should obey detailed balance, which is where you see this Boltzmann factor coming from right here. So this is a statement of detailed balance right here, right? But where this actually comes from is from the Hankel identity itself. If I flip the sign in the index of the Hankel function, it spits out these exponentials, which is exactly this Boltzmann factor. So this is a rigorously thermal power spectrum, okay? Second thing I want to say about this term right here. We have to sum over both these transitions of up and down, excitation and de-excitation. This term right here comes specifically from a Rindler frame analysis. We did the original computation in the lab frame and the Minkowski frame, but we want to sit there and talk about the Umbro effect and thermality. So we wanted to do a Rindler frame analysis to tie this process specifically to an exchange or interaction with the Rindler bath. And so let's go ahead and look at that Rindler frame analysis. This is a prescription put forth by Cozella and Matsis down in Brazil. So if we were to consider in the Rindler frame, right? In the Rindler frame, I have my horizon at a distance of 1/A, where A is my acceleration, with, in principle, Rindler or Unruh radiation coming from this horizon at some temperature. Now, we all believe that this is going to be the Fooling-Davies Unruh temperature, but what we can do is leave this temperature arbitrary for the time being, okay? And for a co-moving channeling oscillation, what we find is that, say, if I have a co-moving frequency, capital omega, and an amplitude of that oscillation, the radiator will resonantly couple upon thermalization, when it thermalizes, to emit particles. Let me back up. Our energy gap will be set to the Rindler frequency of these particles, where that Rindler frequency is defined by the amplitude of that channeling oscillation, the frequency of that channeling oscillation, and then the photons that get emitted are determined by this expression here. Okay, so this, and what we're doing is we're emitting and as well as absorbing, accompanied by it also an emission. So the emission and absorption of these Rindler particles at this specific frequency, okay, where we need this amplitude and frequency at some temperature, all right, are something that we need to include into our analysis. Take into account the absorption and emission, we have these thermal factors which go specifically into our computation, okay, at an arbitrary temperature. This is absorption, this is emission. And so the sum total of both terms gives this thermal factor here, all right? Now, in the Minkowski side, in the lab frame side, right, we have our statement of detailed balance here, where we sum over both decays and excitations. We get our total emission rates. Okay, so we have our detailed balance thermal factor here. Both these terms in the Rindler frame calculation and the Minkowski frame calculation are not affected by the calculation. They essentially wash out, and all the integrals, whatever you could do on your own, and these terms just fall right out. And because these two processes have to be two covariant descriptions of the same emission rate, we can set these equal to each other. And so in our lab frame computation, where we have the detailed balance, what we can do is we can unwind that statement to that thermal distribution here, which takes into account an arbitrary Rindler temperature. And we want to do this is because now we can best fit our data set to determine or to measure this Rindler temperature itself to confirm that it is in fact the Fooling-Davies-Umbro temperature. So this prescription, knowing exactly what co-moving process corresponds to the photons that are emitted in the lab, we can use those photons to directly measure what that temperature is, which is what we're going to do. And you could check and see if I simply substitute omega Rindler is delta E and TR is the Fooling-Davies-Umbro temperature, this collapses to this identically. So let's look at how we compare to data.
So Morgan, can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
Your particle is oscillating back and forth. So the acceleration is not a constant. Isn't that true?
This is true, but we decouple it. That the acceleration in the longitudinal direction is much, much greater than the transverse, that it kind of decouples.
I see. So you're assuming just there's a constant longitudinal acceleration.
Yes.
And then you just ignore the other, or you say that the other one is.
In fact, the transverse oscillation is, it's something like 10 orders of magnitude small. It's much, much smaller than the longitudinal.
So it's just a constant acceleration. Okay. I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now let's look at how we can compare this to data. Here's our power spectrum. First things first, we want to get an idea. We were talking about the acceleration, the longitudinal acceleration. So as this particle penetrates into the crystal, it emits photons in the forward direction. The proper acceleration that we expect comes from relativistic Newton law, 1/mass, and then change in momentum over the change in time. Well, the change in momentum can be simply read off from the power spectrum. It's equal to the momentum of the photons, right? So we have a factor of frequency from the photon itself. And then the time it takes, remember this photon is building up around the positron and then just gets emitted. So we expect the time it takes this photon to be emitted is on the order of a period. So we take it to be pi over the frequency. And so we end up with a recoil acceleration. This is the kick that comes from the photon emission, which gives us this recoil acceleration. Okay, so this is kind of, not to say a prediction, but this gives us the intuition about where the acceleration is coming from. And we hopefully will confirm that later on. We also want to do best fit parameterizations. We want an overall scale factor to take into account detector efficiencies. In fact, there are actual foils and things like this that are there to ensure a single photon spectrum actually present in the experiment. We want to do our best fit for our acceleration A. And so we, you know, want to make sure that it's something on the order of this omega over pi m. We want to best fit for that Rindler temperature itself to confirm that it is the Fooling-Davies-Unruh temperature. Our energy gap, right? We want to take into account these the recoil, okay? So we have something that looks like omega squared over 2m. But we also know that we should have something that looks like a channeling oscillation. Okay, so that should be our linear term. We also have that fiducial Rindler term, the A1 term, which should come specifically from that resonant emission and absorption from the Rindler bath. And it should equal simply the amplitude of the oscillation multiplied by A0 here, which is that channeling oscillation. We also have a radiation reaction term. This would look like 1 over 2m, something like this. And then we also include an additional higher order term just to take into account other things, maybe some cross terms that we don't know about. But so we don't have much intuition about this one, but we did it for the sake of completeness. So what we want to do now is look at best fits using these parameters and compare it to our power spectrum and then compute the chi-squared per degree of freedom for those. First thing that we need to do is ensure that our system has time to thermalize. Just like when you put a thermometer in your mouth, you have to leave it in for a minute for the temperature to thermalize with your body temperature. So if we do a best fit to the entire power spectrum, we end up and then compute the thermalization time from that or the emission lifetime from that. This red curve here is the best fit to the entire power spectrum. We see indeed that there is a thermalization cutoff at about 22 GeV. This blue line here is the 3.8 millimeter thick crystal thickness divided by the speed of light. Since we're ultra relativistic, we just take it to be the speed of light, the velocity. And so this is how much time we're in the crystal. And so we see that there's a cutoff at 22 GeV. Above which the system has time to thermalize, below which the system is not thermal, and this theory, which is thermal, cannot apply to it. And so when we do our best fits, so this implies that we need low energy cutoffs when we do our best fits, right? So we took integer multiples of 10 GeV, and on the right-hand side here, we see the chi-squared per degree of freedom rapidly converge to this one standard deviation threshold. What this means is that inside the red and the blue curve here, that on average, the theoretical curve lies with inside the error bar of every single data point on average, okay? And so what that means is that we have a very, very good agreement of the theory to the data. And so what we have now is the chi-squareds for each cutoff rapidly converges to this one standard deviation threshold right above the first one above that 22 GeV cutoff, okay? So let's talk about the different colors here. So the light blue is whenever we do our best fit, keeping the arbitrary Rindler temperature, okay? And then the black one is where we set that Rindler temperature to the Fooling-Davies-Unruh temperature and then best fit with the acceleration. So right away, the fact that we see these overlapping each other is already a strong indication that we're seeing that Rindler temperature is the Fooling-Davies-Unruh temperature and that they're overlapping and doing a good job of explaining the data. We could also set the energy gap equal to zero. This would be like a Bremsstrahlung type theory. And so this also gives good agreement, but the fact that we have it better with this energy gap shows that it's preferred over a non-over a vanishing energy gap. Okay, so historically, this is ruined.
What is energy gap? What does that mean?
Oh, this term right here. So the energy gap, what we have, the difference between the initial and final state of the positron. So what that means is you have some dispersion relation. So normally what happens is you have E initial, E final, and this is the momentum. So there's a momentum dispersion relation, which takes into account all the processes that are there. This normally comes from integrating over the spatial modes, which we don't have because we're using the Unruh DeWitt detector. So normally there's gonna be a conservation of momentum statement that gets plugged into here, which we lose via the Unruh DeWitt detector approximation. And so we just Taylor expand this and just essentially guess what this energy gap would be, which is the difference between initial and final energy with the conservation of energy momentum statement lost. But we can make an educated guess with our analogy from the anomalous Doppler effect for our constant, from the Rindler term, which we affixed specifically to make the covariant description, from the recoil example from the Cherenkov, and then some higher order cross term, something else. And so this is how we define our energy gap.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, yeah, so thermalization time, this has caused lots of problems, say with spin flip and these Belli-Innis experiments. Again, we have a 22 GeV thermalization threshold, and then we see that chi-squared converges right to one above that threshold. So let's now look at our power spectrum compared to the other models. The first one, that 30 GeV cutoff. On the left-hand side here, we have our standard catalog of radiation reaction models. On the right-hand side here, we see our thermalized acceleration model. If we look at the chi-squared per degree of freedom, Chi-squared per degree of freedom. The number of degrees of, degrees of freedom here is 150 GeV for these guys, and then it's 150 GeV minus six. Excuse me, 150 degrees of freedom for for these guys, and 150 degrees of freedom minus six. Six is our total number of best fit parameters. And so we are the only one that's within this one standard deviation threshold. And so this is the one that gives us basically our best and respectfully only good description to the data. And these are all based off of that Lorentz force and with the recoil correction, those models based on those. We could also mention that the low energy portion below the 22 GeV is not thermalized. This is not thermal. Above it is thermal. Okay. And we also have this kind of transient period up to the 30 GeV where the chi squared goes to one. And so if you want to look in, say, the time domain, if I take the Fourier transform of this, you actually have time resolution where the system is not thermal. And then the channeling radiation information burns off and thermalizes. And so you have a potentially the ability to witness the onset of a thermality in the time domain, in like real time, just by Fourier transforming this. And so this gives us a little bit of insight into the information loss paradox.
Can I ask you, this red curve on the left, that looks like similar quality of it to yours.
Sure.
But I mean, I guess what you do is that you exclude everything below 30 GeV, is that right?
But yes.
But for them, you're not excluding anything, looks
no,
like.
No, they're not. Okay. And so this is the thing that what I wanted to talk about is because they're dealing with classical emission radiation, right? But all of a sudden the system is thermalized. And so it looks like they're able to fit the high frequency, but then not the low frequency. And so that's what I think is that the mm-hmm. system actually needs to be thermalized to describe the data.
You know? But I mean, if you apply the same cutoff to their models that you're applying to yours above 30 gigahertz, then I guess the red model was going to be similar to yours.
I think so. And I believe that that should be the case. What I can say about that quantum radiation reaction model, what they do with that. So that's the red curve, this quantum radiation reaction model. This is a model where they do time step evolution, okay, of the channeling radiation data. There is what's called a Doyle-Turner string potential. So you have the various atomic sites, which gives you your electric field, except they're highly contracted. So it essentially becomes a line of charge. And so that is the electric field that gets plugged into the Lorentz force equation of motion. And they use no recoil corrections at all. It's purely Lorentz force. And they do time step evolution to get the acceleration, the velocity, et cetera. And they plug those parameters into the Leiter-Weitzscher potentials to compute the radiation that's emitted. So in principle, you have the co-moving oscillation that's there just like we do. And then what they do then is they use a quantum radiation emission. So this is from Redis, I believe. So this is a quantum recoil correction that they have for in QED. And then what they do is they roll the dice to determine what frequency of particle or photon was emitted, and then by hand subtract that by hand off of the momentum. So this acts like the recoil kick that we're using, but they do this by hand in their time step evolution. And so I think that that's why this one looks so well, is that it's conceptually very similar to what we're doing. We incorporate the recoil in the energy gap. They incorporate the recoil by hand in their Monte Carlo simulation time step evolution. You know, evolve using the Lorentz force, roll the dice on a quantum photon emission model, subtract that photon from the momentum, and then take the next time step evolution is how they do these things. And so, yeah, it already very similar flavors in what they're doing, you know what I'm saying? One of the things, though, is I should mention this one. I still assume that the acceleration is constant. It's a 3.8 millimeter thick crystal. So the positron just shoots right through it. So velocity, acceleration, everything is functionally constant for these things, right? So if you have thicker crystals, where all of a sudden the time dynamics is needed, I would expect that either you would have to take this formula and use a time step evolution, but this one would eventually probably win over because it actually has the full time dynamics with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And could you elaborate, or maybe you can do that later, this potential window into the information loss paradox? What do you exactly mean by that?
So we want to look at where does the information go? Okay. So think about it like this. If I were to take a dictionary and just throw it into a black hole, right? Or a picture, whatever, just throw some information to a black hole. What does it actually look like as it goes away, as it disappears beyond the horizon? We see red shifting and eventually it goes away. You know, just what is the actual process of the information going away? And so with this power spectrum, right? If we Fourier transform this into the time domain, again, this stuff above the 30 GeV is thermal. It's thermalized. The stuff below it is not thermal. It's pure channeling radiation. And so if we Fourier transform in the time domain, you know, say if we can compute, say, an entropy, which I could actually do later on, look at the entropy and extract the entropy from the data set, but as a function of time. And so you'll be able to see where, you know, in early times you have channeling radiation, so it'll be whatever entropy it is. And then later on, this will burn off as the system thermalizes. And so you get to see, you know, with time resolution, the actual disappearance of the radiation or the thermalization of the system. So essentially, you see the channeling radiation burning away, you know. And so this is where I think it's kind of a cool idea that you can look at these things. So now let's look at our actual best fit parameters. So again, here's our 30 GeV cutoff. Okay, so what we expect, so our measured on the top and what we expect on the bottom. So we have our overall scale factor within reason. It's not like we're orders of magnitude off. Okay, and at the same time, so we don't have any intuition on this one, and nor intuition on the A cubed, the higher order term. But these four here are the ones that are important. Okay, so first of all, the best fit for the acceleration. Okay, we expect something to be on the order of 6.2 PeV. Remember, this acceleration comes from the kick from the recoil. So if I just look at the 100 GeV photon, okay, it's just a characteristic photon, I get 6.2 PeV. So these are large accelerations, and our best fit parameter. For the 30 GeV cutoff is about 8 PeV. So just by the fact that we're in the same order of magnitude here, this are, and you know, we have some smearing because each photon should in principle thermalize at its own frequency. But this is also the confirmation, this can be viewed as a confirmation of the presence of recoil. These accelerations are incredibly large and it's kind of hard to get these by accident. Then if we look at our channeling oscillation term, right? So in the co-moving frame, right? We have, in terms of GeV, we got, you know, 10 to the minus 3 GeV. But in the co-moving frame, this is about a 5 electron volts is what we measure, 5 electron volts. And what we expect something to be of the order of 10 electron volts, plus or minus, you know, a couple percentages. This is just the co-moving oscillation that you see in the co-moving frame, something around 10 electron volts, okay? But what's important is this A1 term, which is coming from that pure Rindler coupling to the particles in the Rindler bath, right? And that term should equal that co-moving channeling oscillation multiplied by the amplitude of that oscillation. So if you look up the lattice constant for silicon, it's about 5 angstroms, and simply just multiply it by this term, you end up with 0.01. This is the number that we would expect, and our best fit parameter for it is 0.02. So in very good agreement with this. And so this is like essentially the confirmation that we measured that Rindler term that we're coupling to. The emission and absorption resonantly with these two terms from the Rindler bath is what this term implies here. And then the A2 term is what we would expect from recoil, okay? Expected is 978.2, that's 1/2m. 1/2m is what we get for our recoil term, and our measure term is 846. So we're at least within 10%. And so this, in terms of our energy gap, shows that we guessed correctly, that we, you know, our intuition based off of Cherenkov radiation and this resonant coupling with the Rindler term. So we were able to successfully guess what our energy gap was. Now let's look at our temperatures themselves, right? So we have our Fooling-Davies-Uhuru temperature, which comes from the acceleration. So what we did was we averaged the accelerations from each of the cutoffs from 30 to 100 GeV. We get 1.8 petaelectron volts. Here, the error just comes from the standard deviation of the mean, so it improved with higher statistics. And then when we look at the averages of the temperatures measured from the Rindler bath, our best fit Rindler temperatures, again, for the 30 up to the 100 GeV cutoffs, we get 1.96. Again, the error is the standard deviation of the mean. And so what we do now is we've actually able to measure that what the temperature of that Rindler bath is and show that indeed it is the Fooling-Davies-Uhuru temperature. And so this is viewed as essentially the virtual measurement of that of these temperatures, of this fluctuations of the quantum vacuum. This was the experimental idea or proposal put forth by Cozzella and Matas and the collaborators down in Brazil. That's Cozzella, Landolfo, Matas, and Benzella. And so this measurement, in terms of actually confirming the resonant coupling with these particles from the Rindler bath, as well as the measurement of the temperature, then confirms the predictions of Fooling-Davies and Uhuru that we can see these thermal fluctuations with this temperature. And so what we want to do now is you know, we have the chi-squared, we have these measurement of the temperatures and these coefficients, which all point toward the presence of acceleration-induced thermality. And so we want to find some independent corroborating evidence to support this observation. And to that, we wanted to look at the thermodynamics of space-time themselves, okay? Since we are thermalized, we have a Rindler horizon. We want to look at the flux of radiation into that Rindler horizon. And so let's look at our area entropy law. And so what I want to do is look at a temperature, right? Temperature with a Fulling-Davies Uber temperature, but I want to write this in a specific way, which I'll show in a second, right? So some dimensionful factor A, which makes sure that we have the correct units, but I want to see that we have a temperature which depends on units of energy E, okay? E to the nth power, right? So if I look at the entropy change, right? And here is our energy, which we, this is supposed to be energy in the proper frame, okay? This is why I write this temperature in units of energy here, okay? So this is energy in the proper frame. So I get an additional factor of gamma. Gamma I could write as E over M, so I have E to the N plus one. And since we're integrating over energy here, this is why I write the temperature in terms of units of energy, okay? So there's almost an equation of state that you can get for whatever process you have, right? But temperature is equal to some energy of, say, a particle beam to some power N. And so from that, we can compute our entropy here, okay? The change in the area we could get by this changing in the size of the Rindler horizon as we flux energy momentum into it, okay? And with the same scaling of our acceleration, we could have our change in area given by this expression. And so in general, our change in area to entropy, depending on this equation of state here with some parameter n, will look like this expression here, okay? And we want to apply this to this to the Rindler horizon that should be present in our thermalized channeling radiation system, okay? So let's look at that specifically. Okay, so the expressions for this channeling radiation area entropy ratio, this comes from Bianchi and Sons. This is Eugenio Bianchi, who was actually a postdoc at Perimeter when he wrote this paper. And if we take our recoil temperature, which comes from the kick from that recoil, right? Writing this in the proper frame, we have an energy to the square to the second power. So this is kind of like a E to the square kind of equation of state. We end up with this area entropy ratio, okay? And whenever we simply plug in the data here, delta E, what we do is we have the power spectrum. I integrate the total area or the total area of the power spectrum minus everything below that cutoff, okay? And I take that energy, I just make a little ball of it and simply drop it into the Rindler horizon, okay? Which gives my change in area, okay? And the initial energy here is the initial beam energy minus the energy cutoff. So what we're doing is whenever we're taking into account all of the energies and integrations in here, all we're doing is we're getting rid of everything that's not thermal and only integrating piece by piece with all the thermal stuff removed, okay? And so when we look at the area entropy ratio, what we find is that this thing converges, okay, to four times the Planck area, okay, four times the Planck area, right at that same 22 GeV threshold, okay? At the same 22 GeV threshold, yeah. And so this right here was our independent corroborating evidence that we do in fact see thermality. What we're, you know, these Rindler photons that we're emitting and absorbing are, you know, resonantly coupled to emit and absorb are the ones that are going into this, into the horizon. And each time those photons goes in, the area and the associated entropy increases, and that the ratio of that actually obeys the Bekenstein-Hawking area entropy law, which is what we see here by that convergence to the 4 GeV. Okay, so now let's just look at a couple things from our future outlooks, okay? First of all, you know, we want to talk about the analog gravity community. So, you know, formally, I always think I work in quantum field theory and curved space-time, which is a long, long name. So as these experiments have built up with these analog models, so this community is slowly being called analog gravity, right? And so now you have seen things like Parker radiation in these systems, you have Hawking radiation in these systems, and now with these high-energy channeling radiation experiments, you all get UNRU radiation in these systems. And so you can view you know, acceleration as an analog to gravity. So, you know, I like the idea of being able to include these experiments into this already kind of flourishing community. And so I hope that this one sticks and that we can you know, keep on analyzing these experiments. With that in mind, there's actually more experiments that are out there. So this is the total of all of the more data sets they have. So what is that? That's six, what do they, so there's 10 more data sets that they have already out there right now with a variety of beam energies and samples. They're silicon and diamond samples of various thicknesses. And so one of the things that I would like to do is to apply these same theory, theoretical descriptions, both the power, the thermalized power law, as well as the our power spectrum, excuse me, as well as the Bekenstein-Hawking area entropy law, and apply it just in mass to all of these data sets. And you can even see just by looking at them that there's also still tension with the models that you see here. Sometimes these data points aren't looking so good, you know, and so I think that there might be some signatures of thermality in these systems as well. And so to conclude, So commenting on the fact that we have this recoil acceleration measured and in agreement, these high PEV scale accelerations and PEV scale temperatures. I should also mention that these temperatures are actually world record highest temperatures. This beats the Quark-Gluon plasma by about 7 orders of magnitude. This is 10 to the 19 Kelvin, okay? Very high temperatures. And we are also able to confirm that recoil with this 1/(ω²/2m) coefficient. Okay, so not only were they able to measure radiation reaction or this recoil, also the Unruh effect. We've directly measured that Fleming-Davies Unruh temperature from the bath. We have the chi²(1). We have that fiducial Rindler term, which we of the resonant coupling to and from the Rindler bath, which we confirmed from our best fit parameter, and it was the best of our best fit parameters. We got the Bekenstein-Hawking area Edgeby law converging to 4 times the Planck area above the same thermalization threshold. And so in general, with this chi-squared statistic and all of the evidence that we have here, what we have now is this acceleration-induced thermality, or all of this thermality that we get from quantum field theory and curved space-time that all of these analog models are examining, but now we have it for a fundamental system. And in the future, yeah, I would like to look at these NA63 data set and just apply en masse, do a world analysis to all of these to these new crystal samples. And I want to just conclude with the last sentence on the NA63 website. The concept study at NA63 even applying a gravitational analog Hawking radiation from black holes, which remains to be detected. But it does appear that this is the case, that it has been seen that these guys have produced this Rindler horizon and thermalized their radiation with it. And so with that, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak. And I'd like to answer any questions that you guys may have.
Thanks a lot, Morgan. Let's all thank our speakers. Are there any questions? First of all, the students. Don't be so shy.
Did I speak too fast? Is it too much information?
There is a question by Hank. Please go ahead.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, sorry, this might be a stupid question, but I'm just wondering, like, does the Unclog process, does that play a role in what you guys are doing, or?
Which process?
Unclog.
I actually don't even know what that is. I don't even know if I've heard of that.
Yeah, so like in a crystal lattice where you have a periodicity in cases, okay, then you can have scattering processes across a like a momentum that is larger than one unit cell or one reciprocal unit cell, but then because the lattice is actually ordered, so then the momentum is sort of like discretely periodic. So then the process. So what I want to say is, like, for example, if you have your positron and the electrons in the silicon crystal, they sort of interact in the reciprocal unit cell, but then I was wondering, like, if the momentum gets large enough such that it sort of folds over, right, to the next unit cell, but then
I think I understand your question. Yeah. So now the exact details of this, I'm not too sure how this works, but I do know that in these systems, you get incredibly large formation lengths for these photons. And the fact that these photons are so big, I think actually that might be the underlying phenomenon for what's actually causing the radiation reaction. What's happening with these positrons as they're going through is the photon actually just builds up bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger around the positron. So you have these large formation lengths, right? And I think that is it due, in fact, to the regularity of this lattice that you're saying, because that's exactly how they're able to achieve such high energy photons. Like in the co-moving frame, you know, you have the positron, which is half a MeV of rest mass. The photons themselves are at 400. I think the biggest one is like 470 keV, with the rest mass 511 keV. And so the fact that you build up this gigantic photon, I think, is probably due to that lattice structure. I know the language in terms of this formation length, but I think that might be the underlying cause of it. This, you know, the regular lattice structure that's enabling the photon to stick to it longer and causing it to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can look into that one, but that sounds like what's causing the underlying mechanism for the formation length.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, it does sound like it. Yeah, so yeah, there are incredibly large formation lengths for these photons. They build up for long periods of time and take a while before they finally get emitted. But it sounds like it's something probably from the lattice which is causing that buildup. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions by students? Okay, not for now. Any more questions by students or non-students?
Well, if there is no more question, I can ask one more question. It is how you measure this delta A bit. Can you elaborate? I mean, what is the area? Because I mean, I don't see an area in these pictures.
So from what I gather, this was from the work of Eugenio Bianchi. Mm-hmm. Is that what you have is, out of the way here. Hold on. Okay. Is that you have, you have your Rindler horizon, which is essentially a black wall. Okay. It's infinite in all directions. Right. And if you have, say, an area, okay, just a circle or a ring that is, now I'll say, okay, I'll give the example this way, and then I'll talk about how it's done in the paper. Okay. So if I just take a ring of null vectors, okay, that you see right here, just imagine these null vectors spanning around a circle right here. Right. And then if I'm emitting these photons, right? So these would be, in principle, every single photon that gets emitted are the ones that we measure in the laboratory when you're thermal, okay? So when these photons get emitted, right? You have this Ray Chaudhuri Ricci scalar, which is seeded essentially by the energy momentum content of the photons themselves, okay? And then you have these null vectors, which are coming out of the surface of this horizon, which then sense the curvature produced by those photons and then causes a bending of those null vectors. And so they are geodesically, deviated. And then if we trace that deviation back, almost like the light ray bending of the stars around the sun, like the apparent location rather than where the actual location is, okay? That is how you determine the change in area size. This is Bianchi and Sots, what they had done.
But your calculation is just the energy. What you did from your experiment, you just measure those energies.
And so the areas come from integrating. So the change in the area. This is where you see the flux of energy momentum coming in and the change in area from that. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then the entropy we just simply integrate. But the area comes actually from that geodesic deviation from the particles.
So you measure delta E and EI, and those are the two things I guess you measure from your experiment.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just the simple. And the integration. So the other couple things that we did to go into this was we assumed just time dependence. So I multiply, so I have to integrate a power spectrum. So I just multiply the time, which is the 3.8 millimeters divided by the speed of light. And then also, which was important to get the, this was actually kind of funny, was the crossover here at the 22 GeV is actually originally at 30 GeV. What I had to do was then subtract out the time it takes for the highest frequency to thermalize, the 150 GeV time, the highest, the first term to thermalize, you have to get rid of that as well. Everything that's not thermalized before that. So you have to rescale the time by the time it takes for that first frequency to thermalize. And then it snaps it to the 22 GeV. And I think this is why also the power spectrum, we couldn't get the chi-squared to go to 1 at 22 GeV, but only at 30, okay? And I think it's because we didn't subtract out that thermalization time of the highest frequency there as well. So you did have to take into account, the reason why I did that, what reminded me is because I did the experiment in grad school and grad lab whenever you're doing a muon lifetime, and you have to take into account like the speed of light in the cables whenever you measure these things. And so it was that intuition that brought me to that one. But other than that, it's just pure integration and just rescaling the time by the time it takes for that first frequency to thermalize, and then just add up the bins is all it was. Mm.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? Maybe I can ask a question. So when you parameterize this energy gap in terms of a Taylor series, so you go to cubic order, right?
Yeah.
Is there any reason why you stopped at the cubic order in particular? Did you check what happened if you would include a quartic term or even higher terms? Does the fit get better? Or is the cubic term really necessary on the other hand?
So I'm not too sure that the cubic term is actually necessary. We simply did it because we had a grip on the first three terms. And just to make sure that we just did it because we didn't know what it was. We wanted to at least put something out there that we didn't have some intuition for, you know, just, you know, for the sake of completeness type of thing. We didn't want to go to a fourth order term because the chi-squares actually take a long time to run. It's each one of these is like 2 hours and we had to do, I think, something 120 of them, something like this. So it was really long time. So that's why we didn't go higher order. I did actually spend a little, I was never able to successfully do it because what we did was we guessed the dispersion relation. We guessed the Taylor expansion. And I did spend a little bit of time trying to guess the actual full delta E, you know, that goes in the square root type of thing, just so we could have something a little bit more sensible. But I wasn't able to make any headway in that respect. But that's still like, I guess there's ways that we can do that with, as an example, I suspect that because of the fact that we had the channeling oscillation, right, that, you know, Nyesh had asked this, you know, are we including that in the acceleration? Or are we including that in the current, right? Because we're not including that in the current. We're just including it in the energy gap, right? But if you include that in the current, you get that actually, I'm pretty sure you'll get Bessel functions, harmonics of Bessel functions due to this oscillation. And so that might give us more structure or a better dispersion relation. And so I think relieving the Unruh-DeWitt detector approximation or trying to, do a little bit more of an accurate description, maybe even still using Unruh-DeWitt detector would diminish the amount of parameters that we have and maybe even get us to the full dispersion relation. That's something that I've actually been trying to think about for a long time. And I'll come up with ideas every now and then and try to do the chi-squared fits, but it ends up they're not working. I'm missing something. I'm not getting it right, you know?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But this following up on that question, so did you try the fit without A3 or not?
I believe so. And honestly, if I recall correctly, is that it doesn't work as good.
Yeah, well, that's the question. How much does it change? And yeah, I guess that's what it do.
I don't remember the exact amount, but it gauges the very, very high frequency tail end. So it gives you, you know, some kind of, it lifts up the tail a bit at the end. So what it does is it doesn't affect anything down here. It affects the high frequency end. Yeah, that one I remember did saying that actually, yeah. And you actually do see, I can say this actually. So first of all, so we have the chi-squareds. The chi-squared always remains inside the one standard deviation threshold. It always does. But it does actually begin to wiggle a bit, okay? And then at the same time, if you note, for the area entropy law, we also only included it up to the 100 GeV. Right? Because it also begins to depart there as well. So I think that there's two things that I could think of that's occurring. Is there is a hard process that's occurring that is not thermalized, a hard and fast process that doesn't have time to thermalize, which is deviating things, right? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there's also, this was papers by Eduardo Martin Martinez, the difference between V.A interaction and E.X interaction. And it turns out the one is not gauge invariant. You start to see it right in the regime where you start to see the highest recoil. So as soon as this the electric field starts to become on size of the electron, which is where you're in the recoil regime, you start to get gauge variant terms that you have to take into account. And so this was so what we have is the finite window within. That's why I kept it from 30 to the 100 GeV because that's where everything was clean. But I do believe that there is either a higher order process, a hard process that's occurring at high frequencies, or the V.A interaction breaks down. There's physics that's happening in the high frequency. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, then let's thank Morgan again for this nice talk.